Welcome to Continued Success. Another Friday. I was going to say in the books, but you know, it's probably about midway through the day. So
yeah, still don't
wanna,
happening.
Don't want to say that it's over quite yet. Hi, I'm Justin Clue of Baseball Prospectus. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports.
Hello.
Another week in the books, we could say.
Yes, indeed.
Hey, how about that?
1 week closer to baseball.
Inching ever closer to the sport we've spent months and months talking about without it being played. I mean, there was 2 months of baseball in the last, how many months? 12 months?
Yeah, something like that. Like, yeah.
It's like we're talking about a mythical game that just doesn't exist anymore outside of ancient texts. Like we're referencing something that is barely a memory, something from a dream. You know, because it makes no sense, and
yeah.
You know, it happens in slow motion. So, yeah, that's where we are with baseball again. Liz, was this an exciting baseball week for you?
Sure.
Yeah, I hear you. This is largely a lot of I can't wait to get to the 3 days of baseball being televised that I can watch, and then being eager for the regular season to start. Kind of season. We did get a spring training schedule, didn't we? Our TV schedule. I think the Phillies are airing everyone except for two games, I believe is what I saw, will be
nice.
On television, which is a market improvement, certainly. And they also renamed their spring training facility. It's now BayCare Ballpark. Do you care
about that? Well, what's it
before? I forget.
Spectrum I don't
Field?
Care.
Was it Spectrum Field at that point?
I guess so. I guess. I know I thought something down there was named for David Montgomery, but maybe not.
Well, they named the complex, and then they named the fields, and at one point it was the Carpenter Complex. But yeah, you're right. I think David Montgomery's name got put in there at one point. And but at this point, it is BayCare Ballpark. Head on down to the old BayCare, they say. Get on the public transit here in Clearwater and just truck it on down to the old Care by the Bay. We'll get there. So anyway, this is, of course, a podcast. We're going to talk about some current Phillies happenings and then go back in time to 2011 and talk about what was going on with that last great Phillies team to finish with over 81 wins. Hey, speaking of which, I've got a story up on Baseball Prospectus right now. They let me do the playing the percentiles Phillies season preview, which is what they did last year. It's a season preview for the Phillies, but the format is it breaks down all these percentile outcomes and the likelihood of where the team will finish. And so you get to write about whether the Phillies finish as a, say, 91-win team all the way down to what it would look like if they finished as a 75-win team, because that's where the Baseball Prospectus algorithm has them finishing between 75 and 91 wins, which, you know, it's a wide spectrum. And certainly there was a certain point with these potential finishes that I was just like, this is kind of the lowest acceptable number. And that number was like 88, I think 86 wins. I was like, this is acceptable, not great. But like after all this time, it feels like this should be a 90 win team. But like if they finish with 86 wins and fall into a playoff spot, okay, sure. Anything other than that, it felt like, yeah, sure. An 85 win season is technically an improvement, but that's something that's like an Andy McPhail improvement. That's not like a real improvement, you know? So I guess I wanted to ask you, Liz, in that regard, what is a win total that is what's the lowest possible win total you would tolerate from the 2021 Phillies?
Maybe like 86, maybe 85, 86.
So you're in the same place. Okay.
Yeah. Just about. Like I can't accept anything below that. That's too close to 500. And I feel like 90 wins is a big ask.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, sort of. I feel like it shouldn't be a big ask at this point in time, but with all of the facts and reality, I guess it is. So, yeah, I think like 86, 87 is where I'm falling. Anything lower than that, I'm just like, why are we still doing this? How is this still happening?
It'd be interesting to see the reaction to like an 83-win season because it would get... it would get labeled as like the best Phillies season since 2011 because mathematically it would be. It would
by
be the...
a grand total of 2 wins. Yeah. Like, wow.
But I agree with you. I'm just saying they would go that way. They would be like, "Oh, this was our best season in 10 years."
That's what the that's going to be the new. Our bullpen had the fourth best ERA in the second half. Mm-hmm. Well, this was the best season we've had since 2011, and the world is like, shut up!
It's funny because he thought he could put math out there, that famous McPhail quote about the fourth best ERA in the second half. Thought he could put math out there because it's unshakably true, it's objective, and you can't argue with it. And somehow he was still wrong. Like, yeah. his numbers were right, and they would be right again if he said, oh, 83 wins, and that's our best season in 10 years. First of all, Andy McPhail won't be making any speeches at the end of that. I think the days of Andy McPhail press conferences are over.
I think he's
just sitting in an office making his money until the end of his contract, and then he's out. I would be surprised if he was a big part of this front office moving forward. But that being said, if they tried to brag about an 83 win season like they did having the fourth best second half bullpen ERA, you'd have no one would be arguing that it wasn't true. They would just be arguing that it wasn't, that it sucks.
It was good.
That it wasn't good enough.
You know,
not
like
at all.
Just like the bullpen ERA, it's the tone that you're saying it in. It's the way you're saying it. It's the context of what you're saying that is all wrong.
And in this article that I encourage everyone to go read, it starts out, you know, I'm talking about a 91 win season, and I'm talking about, you know, the exact moments that could lead to that, and, you know, breaking it down and mentioning specific players and specific games and specific plays. And by the end of it, when like the Phillies are talking about the Phillies being a 78 or 75 win team, I'm like, all I have is just like, somebody throws a bike at John Middleton's car. Cause that's where I'm putting the fan base at this point. Like, just win the amount of games you need to make the playoffs. Like, being competitive will be great, but you can't just be competitive. Like, patience is over. It needs to just happen.
It needs to happen now. Like, they need to make the playoffs this year. That's kind of, we're saying, well, you know, they need to win 87 games or whatever. Like, they need to win however many games they need to win in order for them to make the playoffs. That's the lowest number of wins that is acceptable to me. I don't care if it's the wild card, doesn't matter to me. They just need to get a chance. I don't care if they get bounced in the first round. They made the playoffs. That's the goal. They competed in the postseason. That's what we've been waiting for.
And this is different from, you know, there hasn't been a Phillies season where we haven't wanted them to make the playoffs. But I think now this is more than just wanting. This is expecting and, in a way, demanding that they do it. And, yeah, this is... They're set up. I think they're set up for it. So I don't think our expectations are out of line here. I think you're right. Imagining this team winning 90 games feels tough, but I don't think it's impossible. I don't. You know, maybe I'll look stupid, but I mean, you know, when does that not happen?
I think if it was impossible, this would be a much different conversation. We're saying that this is, you know, this is the lowest amount of wins because we know it's possible with this lineup and with this this pitching rotation. Like, we know that it is possible for them to do it. They just, I hate that it seems like everything has to break right in order for them to do it, because that shouldn't be true. It should be able to happen without, you know, like, every single thing going right, because it's the Phillies. It's never going to happen.
What would you say to the idea that people are kind of sleeping on the Phillies right now, which is easy to, one of these teams, at least one of these teams, is going to get slept on in the NL East, where there's a bunch of competitive teams, at least in theory. And the Phillies are a team that not anyone that I've seen is really giving a whole lot of credit or expecting to finish in a really exciting spot at the end of the season. They're all putting a lot of the other teams in the NL East ahead of them. So do you feel like the Phillies are better than what the national conversation seems to indicate?
That's a tough question, if only because I think what the Phillies have to do is prove it. They've had with the hiring of Gabe, he who shall not be named, with the hiring of him, like, the Phillies sort of announced themselves, we are now part of the larger baseball conversation. Consider us to be on it. We are ready. And it's been several years. and several major staff changes since then. So everyone, if they're sleeping on the Phillies, I don't think you can sleep on the Phillies. I think where they're being put is correct given historical context over the past few years. Even with a great, a lineup that we think can make it to the postseason, they're going to have to prove it first. They have to actually go out there, win games, and look above competent. They need to be more than competent.
I'm putting this team, I do think that they're being doubted a little more severely than they have to be. And I'm picturing this team as a third, maybe second place team. I think that's a realistic place to put them. Whereas for the most part, I think you're seeing a lot of like fourth, maybe third place projections. And in some cases, some people put them in dead last. So that, I think they're better than that.
I think people are wildly overrating the Nationals. Maybe. I mean, that will absolutely bite me in the ass in like 2 months. But, you know, given how they did last year, granted, it was only 60 games, but I feel like it's more than a World Series hangover.
Yeah, the Nationals have two of the best young players in the game, but they are by no means a powerhouse.
No, like they couldn't, and last year in 60 games, they couldn't put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal the year after you've won the World Series.
Yeah. So, I encourage everybody, go over to Baseball Prospectus, read my story on the Phillies and all the possible finishes they could have in 2021. A fun Friday activity, just like normal people have. Fun Friday activities, just like normal human being Alex Rodriguez having a normal, fun Friday. I don't know if you saw this, Liz, but A-Rod was tweeting this morning about hashtag Flashback Friday.
No, what is he doing?
Which, you know, I think if you're a little more fluent in Twitter, it's Throwback Thursday would be a more appropriate. But he did a Flashback Friday, which I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's really even a thing. Come on, A-Rod. What an idiot. Anyway, he was talking about 2009, which made it, you know, relevant for us. And he said that 2009 will always be special to me. It's the year it all came together for me and my teammates. We were able to make our dreams come true and deliver a championship for the best fans in the world. And, you know, he strung together a couple of tweets about this. And, I don't know. Do you view the 2009 World Series as a redemption arc for Alex Rodriguez, as he apparently does?
No one sees it that way. Literally no one. I'm going to say a lot of people have forgotten that the Yankees won the World Series in 2009.
Hmm.
Because they didn't win it. I don't think they won it that many years before. And they certainly didn't win it. They didn't win it after, did they? 10,
no,
11,
no. No, they won in 2009, and I believe they hadn't won since they lost in 2001, so I guess they hadn't won since 2000. So for them, that's a huge drought, you know, nine years.
Yeah, he remembers, like, this was, you know, it was a World Series, everything came together. I think most people have forgotten it. I mean, at least most people who aren't Yankees fans, and maybe even them, I don't know if Yankees fans consider it to be... It's not looked back upon like any of, like, I don't know if they even look at it like we look at 2011 or 2010. We didn't even win the World Series that year. And yet we look back on these years as like major important years.
I mean, I wish we rooted for a team that could forget some of their World Series titles.
Yeah,
there
fuck
were so
that.
Many.
I can't believe that. Wow.
That would be cool. But I guess in this case, we can just use that to pretend it never happened. I mean, the Phillies have lost to the Yankees in the World Series as many times as they've won the World Series total. So.
Yeah, wow. My God. A-Rod, I feel like there's someone doing these tweets, but yet at the same time, why would someone who is not him write these tweets? His final tweet in the thread is, and hey, we even made a little extra history with the first ever World Series replay review. Still no bonus points for hitting the camera. Who else is ready for some baseball? Who do you think will win the World Series this year? And then he does hashtag Yankees, hashtag champs, at MLB, at MLB on Fox, and at Yankees. Like,
it is kind of a cliche to point out that like he kind of acts like an alien pretending to be human.
He does. He and this is the case with a lot of famous people, that it's like they don't know how to act normal anymore. They have so much money and they've been away from normal people for so long. Like, there's a long story I think that Kevin Smith tells about Bruce Willis, mm-hmm. about how he's essentially an alien who does not know how to act around people who are not Hollywood people. And it's very weird. And I feel like all of A-Rod's media is him trying to convince people, I am like you. Hello.
It definitely is.
This is definitely not a skin suit.
He was the worst person in like most baseball circles for a while, just because of, you know, steroids and the writers turned on him because they liked Jeter and they viewed him as evil Jeter, basically. The Yankees fans hated him because he sucked in the playoffs until 2009. Yeah, and I feel like they still kind of hate him. And yeah, he definitely is trying to pivot into like some kind of branding expert and brought in people to help him rehabilitate his own brand so that he could be like I'm just a fun guy on Twitter who's also like a broadcaster and I just want to hang out and talk about the game. It really feels like with that last tweet, he's walking up to a bunch of people and going, hey, fellow humans, who else is ready for some baseball? And you're like, okay, relax. Like, we are ready for some baseball, but that's not how that question gets asked, and it also is kind of jarring. For still no bonus points from hitting the camera. Who's ready for some baseball? Come on, man. Hey, that's what happens when you're that rich and you're an athlete and you're married to Jennifer Lopez. He's just on a different planet.
Oh no, let me tell you, they are not married yet. I have already staked my claim as I would like to cover this for Yahoo Sports. It will probably be covered by Yahoo Entertainment more. I said I would like to cover this. And I've been waiting ever since for them. They've been engaged for almost 2 years. I've been waiting for them to announce a wedding date. I want to see a wedding dress. I want completely unrelatable wedding details. I had my own wedding about 18 months ago. And now my sister helped me with it. And now our favorite thing is to judge other people's weddings silently behind their backs. And this is one of those weddings that I just want to see all of the completely batshit, you know, details that they're able to afford, and they're not giving me any. Get married already.
That's interesting. I mean, their wedding is going to be like a corporate event, essentially. I feel like it's there's going to be like a lot of artistic choices made, certainly, and aesthetically, it's going to be, you know, an extremely rich couple's wedding. But yeah, for the most part, I think it's going to be like a branding opportunity, essentially.
Oh yeah, it'll definitely be like, all right, so who wants to provide this thing? We'll feature it, you know, part of the deals. We'll feature you in a photo, you know, on Instagram and Twitter. We will mention your, you know, we will at you. We'll do a hashtag, and you know, it's this much more if you want. You know, if you want to be, you know, mentioned twice or something, or maybe they would do their services for free just with the opportunity to be mentioned in a tweet for their wedding. I want this. Hurry up and get married. Hurry up.
I could see the morning of the wedding, A-Rod doing like a scheduled thread about a new app he's launching. Because just he knows people are going to be paying attention to them that day because they're getting married. And I could see him just being like, hey, don't forget to check out my new app, A-Rod, which stands for, my brain's not moving fast enough to come up with this off the top of my head today. I regret painting myself into this corner.
Oh, see, I figured he'd just go, the A-Rod app.
Right. It's a picture of me. It's like my schedule for the week, the meetings I'm attending, what I've looked at, you know, the lunches I've had, very expensive lunches.
Oh, my social media posts.
Mm-hmm. All that great stuff. It's just the A-Rod. It's A-Rod app. It's all about A-Rod.
People who are really, really interested in A-Rod. That he is convinced exists.
Well, I thought that was a fun little bit from A-Rod's world. I do like to check in on A-Rod every once in a while just to see what's going on.
It has been more than 2 hours since A-Rod has 1.2 million followers, which seems low. It has been 2 hours since he posted the first tweet in this thread. It has 374 likes. Mm. And the rest of the tweets in the thread are under 100.
That's not great.
No, people are not into this.
Wow. His engagement. He needs a new social media person in there. Yeah, not pulling their weight.
He needs become a different person. I'm looking through his, like, some of them have, like, a tweet with him and his, he posted a tweet on the 24th of him and Jennifer Lopez. And he's like, I'm missing this girl. And that has, like, 3,300 likes.
Yeah, it's because it's got J-Lo in it.
Well, exactly.
And he knows his strengths.
His tweet, praying for my brother Tiger Woods, and that one got 5,000 likes. He does a lot of retweets, but like the vast majority of his posts, under 500 likes, most of them are under 3. A bunch of them are under 100.
I'm picturing him standing in front of his staff with like a chart. You know, numbers going way down, and he's just like, my likes. Why aren't you guys why don't people like my tweets? And they're like, well, because you're A-Rod, and you're basically like the closest thing baseball has to a war criminal. And, people are reluctant. I don't know. You have a checkered past with the sport. You have a checkered, sleazy past with baseball, and people, you know, even if they don't know the specifics, if they don't remember the specifics anymore, they still look at the name A-Rod and they're just like, eh. And I don't know, pivoting to like a bland corporate branding robot isn't necessarily the change that was going to fix your image. But hey, whatever. He's remembering the 2009 World Series and he's having a good time doing it. That's just great. That's great. All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about what's going on with the Phillies. Bryce Harper did an interview, so we got some fun little sound bites to come out of that. Whether or not the Phillies are going to allow fans in the stands, that'd be something. And yeah, we'll get into that as well as what was going on with the 2011 Phillies right after this. Okay, ready?
Indeed.
3, 2, 1. And we're back. Liz, Bryce Harper was talking to the press yesterday in another virtual press conference. And, he didn't say anything too earth-shattering, but I thought we could pick apart some of his statements and, spend some time doing that. He mentioned that the NL East is, which we talked about at the top of the show, but he talked about how the NL East is something of a juggernaut at this point. Do you feel like it's the best division in baseball? Because Bryce Harper does.
That's a good question.
I'm kind of like, I have high expectations. Again, I was disappointed in this last year, but the Dodgers and Padres being a fun season series, but I don't know, the rest of the NL West doesn't really factor into that. Obviously, the Rockies aren't even really a franchise anymore.
No.
The Giants aren't really a factor, and the Diamondbacks, I don't know. They seem like they've got third place written all over them. So, yeah, I mean, but that being said, I think that's going to be a more entertaining rivalry, perhaps, than anything that happens in the NL East. I feel like the NL East, there's like five teams that could be good, maybe not great, but they all have the chance to be at least good, and they all have a giant pitfall that could undo them as well. So I don't know, the other teams I'm talking about in the West, the Dodgers and Padres, they seem to be, you know, they have strong foundations, they have a ton of depth, they've spent the winter acquiring players, whereas the Phillies, you know, big additions were putting back together the team that they let fall apart. The Mets, they brought in a lot of talent, but not as much as was theorized or expected by their fan base, and there was some pretty significant Metsing that happened throughout the winter, and then some other pretty serious issues that happened organizationally as well. So it's not like they're invincible at this point, despite being a better baseball team.
I think the only division that comes close might be the AL East, actually. Mm. Because, I mean, Tampa Bay hasn't done anything. They've actually gotten worse, but they always seem to find a way to annoy everyone by being good. And there's the Yankees who are good, and the Blue Jays have actually made a pretty big push.
They have, that's true.
Yeah, like I would like for us to not forget that, especially after a number of years of they changed leadership, they got a new GM, and then got like intentionally bad for a couple of years there. And now they're sort of on the rebound. So the AL East, I think, is as close to, like, the AL West might as well not even exist. You see the AL Central full of, there's one team, there are two teams, no, there's one team that is competing and one team that might compete. That's the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's it. I think, yeah, as far as the number of teams that will be actively competitive, I think the NL East has, it's 4 to 5 teams. Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, that's been, I think, clear that this is, that's become the perception, at least, that this is a division with 5 teams. I don't think they all will be competing all year long, but I think at the start here on paper, we're looking at a pretty competitive division. Harper was also talking about how the people he talked to while figuring out if he wanted to come here as a free agent a couple of years ago, of those people, John Middleton's really the only one who's still with the organization or still in the same position within the organization, referring, of course, to Matt Klentak, who was no longer the GM, Andy McPhail, who...
They've already moved his office to the basement.
The new team president doesn't report to McPhail. He reports to Middleton. So I think McPhail's just kind of, is he technically the president of business operations? And like, that's pretty much what he has been this whole time.
Essentially.
He was given the team president title, but you're really supposed to have two team presidents, one for baseball ops and one for business ops. And he's pretty much just been doing business stuff and not super paying attention to the baseball stuff, which, how did no one point that out as a problem? But okay. And then, of course, Gabe Kapler is also gone. And the Phillies are on their third manager since 2017. If you throw Pete McCannon in there, he left and he was managing in 2017, I believe. And then, you know, that's a lot of turnover. Not Harper wasn't here yet, but still a lot of turnover in a short amount of time and a lot of key positions here, especially when the Phillies, I think, thought they were settling in with the regime that was going to take them back to the playoffs. So here we are, and Harper was commenting on that. He talked about Dave Dombrowski coming in as the new team president. Do you really feel like, I mean, how much of an impact did Dombrowski make when he came in here? Like, we're not really sure what conversations happened behind closed doors, but I think it's undeniable that Dombrowski got here, and then it seemed like things really started happening. And maybe that was just because of the time of the winter it was. You know, maybe that's just when the Phillies had planned to do these kinds of things. But to be honest, every time there was a big hire made and all the rumors and things you heard before or reports before the moves actually happened, you kind of got the impression, at least I did, that this team has a certain aspect of making it up as they go in some cases. You know, I feel like at one point there was a plan, but when the plan didn't work, there might have been some in-house panic. That's my perception of this. And then, you know, in hiring Dombrowski, I felt like it was only days before they hired him that they were linked to really wanting to hire a different guy. I think it was that guy from the Twins, who is a different kind of executive. Who's a different kind? He would be a different kind of team president. And then they brought in Dombrowski, who is a very, you know, as we all know, came in with a very aggressive reputation as like a more of a baseball guy than an analytics guy. You know, it just felt like, I don't know, making it up as they go, I guess, to an extent, to put it broadly. So did you feel like Dombrowski coming in was maybe the most important thing the Phillies did this offseason because it seemed to knock a lot of other dominoes down? Or do you view that as they brought him in and parts of a plan that already existed started to happen?
There was no plan. What are you talking about? I feel like that is really the highlight of the Klentak era. It's we have a plan, and it's the only plan.
And it's a great plan, and you can't hear about it.
Exactly. It's we have a plan, and there's no backups. It's like there is no, well, what if this or what if that? I think at least with Dombrowski, it's like there's a plan B, there's a plan C, there's a plan F, there's a plan, you know, T. Like, there are plans everywhere, which is what you need. I think it's definitely the most significant move they made. They have a competent, you know, they have a competent guy at their GM spot now. Not a guy who, not Klentak. Like, I don't want to, I feel it's not fair to disparage him in that way because he obviously did do a couple, you know, some good things, but it always felt like he was tentative. It always felt he was never quite sure. It always felt, at least as a fan, he was never quite sure of, you know, what he was doing next or what would happen if this or that. Like, Dombrowski projects confidence. And that is something I think that's been missing from the Phillies PR in general, is someone who projects confidence. Like, this might not be going to plan, but we have a way to turn it around. And I'm just going to actually say that we have a way of turning it around because we do. As opposed to, you know, hemming and hawing and hedging and then retreating into your turtle shell.
Right about a certain amount of confidence that he brings in, whether or not you have it in him, you know, that there was some debate about that when he was first hired. But I think undeniable, he's a guy who gets things done. And whether or not you wanted those things to get done, that's where the debate's going to lie. But they will happen. So with that being his reputation, let's imagine a world where the Phillies are at or around 500, right around the trade deadline. And they, you know.
You're going in and out, Justin.
There's some moves for them to make. But Dombrowski's at the helm. So, like, how aggressive do you imagine the Phillies being if they look like they're in a position to get better at this trade deadline when we went into this season thinking this team might be punting on 2021, where we went into this offseason thinking, well, they're either going to bring back Real Muto or they're not. And if they do that, it's going to be the only big thing they do. But then they went ahead and brought Gregorius back as well, signed Archie Bradley. You know, seem to be actually addressing things. So do you think this team has a different approach to 2021 now? Do you think if they're in it at the trade deadline, they do something a little more aggressive?
I think if they're in it at the trade deadline, if they have the chance to get measurably better and it could get them over the hump, I think they do it. I think you don't invest this much money into a team and be like, well, sink or swim, bye. You know, that's just not how I don't see them playing it that way. I don't think they can. You know, because they're not punting on 2021. They have invested in the team. And I think they want to carry that over the finish line. They know what the fans demand. They know what the fans want. And they know what, I think their expectations are the same. Like, we need to make the playoffs this year. And if we find out halfway through that the team we have isn't totally getting it done, but there's a way that we could, then let's do it. I mean, I don't know what they'd give up. I don't know who or what they would trade. But, you know, that's a problem for, you know, the Phillies of June and July.
Do you think there was an actual changing of the mind? Do you think that John Middleton entered the offseason not intending to spend a lot of money and thinking more about how to recover from financial losses in 2020? You know, and then Dave Dombrowski got here, or the opportunity to hire Dave Dombrowski presented itself, and he changed at some point, his mind changed and thought, you know what, we will spend some money on this team. Do you think there was some evolution in the approach to 2021, or do you think we just, you know, we've been sitting on the outside and it's been what it's been all along?
I think there had to be, whether, you know, Middleton was as severely on we must recover in 2021, my God, whether he was, you know, that severely in that camp to start, I think that's up for debate. Maybe he was closer to the edge, but I think at some point there had to be a change. I think some of it might have been, we know how easily the man is swayed by fan reaction. He's so easily... Does his mind change when faced with a torrent of, you know, of fan animosity? I think I would like to hope that part of it was the incredible wave of, oh my God, how are you even considering not spending money? I think that had to have weighed into it somewhat. Because otherwise, why do you hire Dombrowski? Why do you go out of your way to hire someone that high powered if you're not like, well, this is what we have to do it. I made a promise, you know, not just to myself, but to the fans. Let's do it.
Do you think he was mad when what was most certainly considered a false report came out saying they had lost like what, $2 billion or something?
Yep. Which was so the MLB losses for the entire season, I think.
Right. Like, do you think that came out and people were like, what the hell is this? And he had a reaction to that. I mean, because that seemed to be a tipping point. Like, it was quickly deleted. I believe it was in the New York Daily News. And it got quickly deleted. No correction was issued. And it was just kind of like people laughed it off.
I think it might have been updated to like in the, you know, 90 million range that they lost, which I don't think made it any better. People were like, that is the same. That is an enormous amount of money that none of us will ever have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to the general public, the difference between 100 million and 2 billion, like, you see it, you know, you understand it, but it's like, how am I supposed to care? I cannot pay $1,000 to get my car fixed.
They need to just reach a point where the team is the story. You know, John Middleton being the main character of the Phillies is not a place where this team needs to live PR-wise. It's only going to result in gaffes. He's only going to say the wrong thing. And I mean, he's saying anything when you're the owner of a losing team is going to be the wrong thing. It's going to be perceived wrong. And also, you're a billionaire at a time where a lot of people are, you know, rubbing two pennies together. So it's rough time for his PR. He needs to stop being the story. The team needs to be the story. I'm not saying he's controlling that. I'm saying the team needs to be, they need to get the team in a spot where it is a good team, a fun team, an interesting team, so that when we have complaints, they're about the players on the field, not about the front office's management or roster building or philosophy towards spending or desire to recover their losses instead of building a competitive team. These need to stop being the main narratives. They really need to get the Phillies to a point where the conversation is, oh, is Bryce Harper's back okay? What can the Phillies expect from the back end of their rotation after like a couple of weeks into the season? It needs to be about the... That is because we just haven't had the amount of baseball we typically have. So we're forced into... This is what the conversation becomes. It becomes, you know, what the owners are saying, what the executives are saying, what the Andy McPhail is saying, and stuff. This fan base is sick to death of that stuff. It needs to be about baseball. And part of that is just getting the players on the field. But then the other part is making sure that when the Phillies take the field, they're a good team. You know, they're a team that's made all of this stuff, this drama, these headlines, these press, make it worth it. Make it worth our while.
Yeah. He wants to say things about the team being good, because he's the type of guy, it seems like he can't let a silence. He just can't let a silence go. Like, if right. people are saying stuff about the team, he wants to fill the silence with information that he thinks is going to help, which no, it won't. Shut up.
And, you know, guess what? If you're the owner of a good team, people are going to come around on you. Like, don't worry. You know, people will think it's cool that you want to walk among the people when the team is good, when the team is contending in the NL East. You won't have to worry about being beloved. People will just automatically love you because that's how being a good sports team works. It is incredible what people will be willing to forgive when you are good at sports. I think we learn that lesson every week in this country. So, yeah, in this particular case, you don't have to worry about public opinion. Make the team good, and the opinion will be, this guy made a team good, and we don't have to talk about him anymore. This is great. Yay! You know, I wish that's where he had understood from the beginning, that, like, that's where your efforts can go. You know, they don't have to be making peace with people, going down among the Fandemic crew to wave an air horn around and get a photo op. Just make the team better. And yeah, I hate this, because then it just starts sounding like he hasn't really done anything, when in truth there's, you know, Bryce Harper, JT Realmuto, the bullpen last year, you know, that's put that on Klentak. You know, there's certainly been fault of everybody organization wide. And that's what I mean when it just comes down to, like, we're ready to just see a good team, so that what we're talking about is the team and not the organization. You know, we've had so many months to talk about the business of baseball, and it's boring. It's a boring conversation.
Yeah, I'm ready to be done with it. Let's baseball now.
So let's be done with it. We're going to take another break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about what was going on with the 2011 Phillies around this time, right after this. Well, in late February, Liz, the 2011 Phillies were, they were at spring training. David Hale of the Delaware News Journal took a fun narrative approach to the season around now, pointing out that Jimmy Rollins had been around long enough at this point to have seen his team become the NL apex predator he once considered the Braves to be. When Jimmy had been a rookie and the Phillies' best seasons were all just near misses, he looked to Atlanta as this ideal franchise, always good, always competitive, always in the postseason. The Phillies had, at this point, kind of become that team, though, as we know now, it was about to come to an end. So I guess this was a conversation we had a lot this offseason, was when the Phillies were hiring key roles at the top of their organization. The idea was, it doesn't have to be about winning now, and it doesn't have to be about rebuilding. It should be about infrastructure. It should be about building this team to be a contender now while also setting it up to succeed in the future. And I guess my question for you is, can 30 teams exist like that? Like, if 30 teams were really trying to build not just a team that's good now, but good later, I just don't think there's enough good baseball players in the world to fill out 30 systems like that. So I'm never really convinced how realistic an expectation it is to set up. Like, yes, it is possible, and you know, a good system is going to be able to have a fertile farm system and a team that contends for the playoffs all the time. That's why we always talk about the Braves teams that Jimmy was idolizing, because for 14 years they won a division. That's an insane streak. Granted, they only won one World Series in that time, but still, that's an insane amount of success. And clearly it was cross-generation because it went on for a decade and a half. So how realistic of an expectation is it for a team to be that successful? Because it takes a long time to set that kind of success up.
I think you're right. It's not necessarily entirely realistic. I mean, I think the ideal would be for all 30 teams to be competitive. It's just not realistic. There's always going to be a Orioles. I'm trying to think of it. I was trying not to say the Orioles because I know you like them. But
Pirates,
there
Rockies.
You go. That's better. Pirates, Rockies. You know, there's always going to be a team doing that. The goal is for there to not be a lot of teams doing that, which there currently are. Like, and then there are teams, who knows what they're doing. What are the Rangers doing? They're not getting worse, but they're definitely not getting better. They're trying to make everyone forget about them, maybe? Can you name one move they've made? Can you name their GM? No. I can't name their manager. I don't think I can name any one of their pitchers.
Is John Daniels still around down there? Is he? Did I pull that off? He's the president. Okay, I got one. Wow. He is the president of the Texas Rangers. He was the youngest GM in baseball when he was hired. He was 28. Good Lord.
Oh, God. Okay, now I remember. I was trying to remember. All right, the GM of the Rangers is someone that got a lot of press in the offseason. And it's former Mets pitcher Chris Young.
Oh, that's right.
He's their
general manager. Very tall man.
Yes. I guess the one thing that the Rangers are doing is something that excites me. It's like, remember when players once became executives? Again, it could happen. The Rangers are helping us realize that future.
Well, also going on in 2011, Larry Boa added to the preseason celebration by saying the rotation the Phillies had in 2011 was the best he'd seen since entering the league in 1970. He was an MLB Network studio analyst at this point.
What a career. Moment, what a life.
A rare moment of him not being employed by the Phillies.
Did he just wear a Phillies uniform on the air? Because that's all he had.
I think he just has one on under his clothes all
at
the time.
All times, he's like Superman, only the opposite, kind of.
Projections, baby. This time of year, they also got Pat Gillick to talk about the assembled roster of the 2011 Phillies, and he said they looked, on paper, better than his 116-win Mariners team from 2001,
ooh.
I want to say.
Ooh, my.
You want to talk about high expectations.
Spicy.
Good Lord. And, Michael Martinez. Speaking
He's
of
back.
High expectations.
Wow.
Finally, he gets his due in the coverage. The Rule 5 pick was hoped to be a continuation of that narrative about the Phillies and Rule 5 success, even though one of them, Ender Inciarte, wasn't good until he left. And another one was Odubel Herrera. His career, you know, is what it is now. But Shane Victorino was obviously the big story from the Rule 5 narrative. But back in 2011, we had Mini Mart, who I don't even think has one moment for which he's beloved, like a Wilson Valdez or Ben Francisco or Danny Baez. Like, you can remember a moment where one of those guys came through for the team, even if they weren't the most popular guy. I think Mini Mart is most famous for that Zoo with Roy meme about him being dead.
Yeah, and he's most famous for always being there. He's most famous for always being around and never, never not being there. I could not avoid him. It was probably, I've lived in Dayton almost 5 years. We went to see a Columbus Clippers game, and we were, the Indians minor league affiliate was playing the Clippers. And Michael Martinez was on that team. This was maybe 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago. We were just like, what is he doing here? Can we not get away from him? Why?
And then he like applies to live in the apartment you're renting out above you just because, you know, he plays for the team in town now. And you're like, no, get away.
Now you're even closer. It's the opposite of what we want.
Nevertheless, Mini-Mart was described by David Hale as starstruck playing on the Phillies, but determined to play. He had a glove for each position he might play, five of them. And the truth is, he sucked, but every team's got a Michael Martinez on it.
you need just a Michael Martinez. They come through once every, let's say, 500 times. They have a chance to come through, but that one time could come at a very important moment.
And, you know, the years following 2011, nobody really remembered who was on the Phillies bench or who what their defensive replacement was. But at this point in Phillies history, we were still assigning personalities and characterization to each individual member of the Phillies roster. And poor Mini-Mart just, you know,
the
Wilson Valdez
guy.
makes it easy by like being the first, by being, you know, by pitching in that game. And the other guys, Danny Baez, I believe he pitched in that game as well.
Yes, he did the best. I think it's the single best pitching outing of his entire career.
Yeah, it was. And like, you remember that. And Ben Francisco had that home run in the playoffs in 2011. So like, you have those moments where you're like, okay, we have something to like base their personality on. But in the case of Mini-Mart, it was just like, yeah, he's like a weak hitting guy who also isn't good at defense, but he does play five positions and he has a glove for each of them. So it's funny. We just settled on him like laying still in the batter's box in that one picture. Like that was kind of our, as far as we got with characterization of him. Well, on Monday, February 21st, the 2011 Phillies took their first live batting practice. In a little less than a week's time, Cole Hamels would be the first ace to throw a game ball for the team against the Yankees in the Grapefruit League. There was something in the daily news about the NL East that focused weirdly on the Marlins, whose players were giving statements about how they were the underdogs against the Phillies and how they were glad they weren't getting the attention the Phillies were getting. Because, you know, they were just doing that classic narrative of like, you know, we appreciate the attention on us because I think we're going to surprise some people, blah, 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 blah. You know, that whole thing. Here's a great segment. Of Florida's 13 losses to the Phillies in 2010, five were by one run, including Halliday's perfect game.
Ooh.
The way Florida sees it, that means they're right there with one of baseball's elite clubs.
All right.
yeah, they beat us 13 times, but five times it was only by one run. So that means we are the same. We are
the same
Phillies. there was some talk about egos on this Phillies rotation in 2011, but I think we dodged a bullet by having five guys who, you know, understood the situation. I'm not saying that there weren't egos, but they at least understood that, like, look, we're all here, and being here together means we can win, and it really doesn't matter what order we pitch in. Like, Hamels could have been pissy that he was the number four starter, but he knew he could be leading any rotation across the league in most cases. It was just that the Phillies had assembled a ton of talent in one place. We've seen plenty of unhinged or dipshit pitchers across baseball in recent years who would have let a good thing be ruined by their ego, and it's cool that, you know, yeah, it only lasted for one season anyway, but at least at no point do I remember someone's ego getting in the way of the team being good.
No. I guess there's still Jeter, but like, this wasn't necessarily a time of that in general. Definitely not with the Phillies. There was never one of those dudes because, you know, Jimmy was outspoken, but it's not like it was to the detriment of his teammates. It's not like he was insisting that it all be about him. No one was insisting that anything be all about them.
But finally, there was some drama. On the same day as a Cliff Lee press conference, Jason Wirth was having one in Washington, and he was asked a lot of smirking questions about going from first to last place, which definitely needled him. I think he hated Philadelphia not long after he left because of stuff like that. I think it really got to him. I think if they played it right, they probably could have had us both, Wirth said, claiming he felt like the Phillies had played Lee and Wirth against each other somewhat, but also noting that that's the business. That was the start of the hateful seed of Jason Wirth in his years in Washington and his resentfulness of Philadelphia, which, you know, was totally warranted in some respects as he was taunted by Phillies fans unmercifully and stupidly. And lastly, Paul Simon, Liz. I know you're a big Paul Simon fan. He was pissed about the Cliff Lee situation. That's right.
The Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel.
Well, we learned this in the Daily News. He was apparently leading an orchestra and stopped rehearsal because somebody was wearing a Phillies shirt, and he's a New Yorker, and he's associated with New York, and he's one of those eponymous New York guys. And he said, "I'm so ticked about the Cliff Lee deal. We really had him. I thought we had him. You guys are really at the beginning of a dynasty here."
Shut up.
A nice thing to say, but was it a curse? Potentially. Yes. I think he was jinxing us because he wasn't willing to go full trash talk, but it felt like he was. Yeah, he felt like he could set up a jinx there. Like, ah, damn it. I think it all fell apart because of Paul Simon.
Yeah, let's blame him. I like that idea.
Also around now, Mike Schmidt recommended the Phillies start considering playing a little more small ball, something they were a little more outfitted to do now. But was Charlie Manuel going to go about things that way? Didn't seem like it. He projected that Rollins and Victorino would have 200 hit seasons at the top of the lineup. So, yeah, I don't know how eager Charlie Manuel ever was to be a small ball manager. And I don't know, even with his offense kind of evolving from the strong point to behind the pitching staff as far as team strengths go, I don't know if he ever considered being like a small ball first kind of manager, just because he likes to hit. He likes the bats to swing and he likes to hit.
I do not think he ever considered it at any point, which is fine. That's just who he was. I mean,
for the record,
he's a man that had a nickname in Japan for being a home run hitter.
And for the record, neither Jimmy nor Shane had 200 hits, but they did lead. They were the top two players on the team in hits, with Jimmy hitting 152, Shane having 145. They were the number one and two leaders on the team in hit totals. So not totally off there, but I think that's also to be expected.
Yes.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Continue.
I want to leave things on a down note.
Oh, great.
I'm happy to. This is the beginning, I believe, of Utley's patellar tendonitis problems, some knee issues, because I dug up a Brookover tweet where he says, "Utley has patellar tendonitis. Amaro says they want him to take it slow. He would not make his debut this season until the end of May."
And then Charlie Manuel also said, "Chase is fine. He's definitely not injured." Which sounds exactly what you would say if you had Chase Utley, who was definitely injured. So
yeah, pretty much. I mean, because it was this season, he started late. He started late in 2012 and 2013. But I think that's when he finally got it figured out. It was either the 2013 or the beginning of 2014, because 2014, he played 155 games. I think that's that's the highest. That is the third highest game total of his entire career. And that's the most number of games he'd play until he retired.
And he was held out of that exhibition game they used to play against Florida State with soreness in his legs. So, yeah, this was the beginning of some concerns there. But for the most part, optimism for the Phillies in 2011 around this time. And frankly, that optimism is happening 10 years on. If you listen to any conversations between me and Chris Jones, I think you'll find pretty high on this team. Part of that's just being excited to see baseball again and having the Phillies back. And I'm trying to separate that annual bout of excitement about the Phillies and baseball and try to figure out, am I really high on this team or am I just excited for baseball to be back? But I really do think this team is better than national projections have put them. And I think this is a promising season. I'm looking forward to it. So I think, we're not going to hit 2011 levels of optimism. We may never hit those levels with this team. But I think you can still feel good about the 2021 Phillies going into this season. I know I will be. As always, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness, this podcast, Continued Success with me and Liz Rocher, and The Dirty Inning with me and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We'll be back. We'll have a new episode of The Dirty Inning next week, all about balks. And don't forget to head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittandseason for $5 a month. You get access to all kinds of bonus content like Absolutely Hammered with me and Chris Jones. We've got a brand new episode of that up right now. Me and Liz reviewed Rookie of the Year for our movie review for February. We'll have another review up next month. Whatever other content we put up there, I think it's well worth the $5. So thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time on Continued Success.